From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. It's been 5 years since hackers targeted Sony Pictures around the release of the studio's North Korean comedy. What has Hollywood learned since that massive cyber attack? Then Lena Waithe, the writer of the new movie Queen and Slim, says her film about a violent encounter between a white police officer and a black couple reflects the nation's racial tensions.
It does feel like we're at war. You know, I think there's this sort of element of people being worried, will this film start a race riot? You know, and will this start a war? Will this make temperatures even hotter?
All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. 5 years ago, just as Thanksgiving approached, employees at Sony Pictures logged into their computers and were greeted by this ominous message.
Hacked by hashtag GOP over a picture of a sinister-looking red skeleton. GOP reportedly stands for Guardians of Peace, a previously unknown group now claiming credit for the hack.
The hackers leaked millions of files, putting confidential employee information and embarrassing emails about the studio's internal workings out in the open. Ben Fritz is an editor at The Wall Street Journal and the author of the book The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. And he remembers being in the Journal newsroom when he heard about the hack.
I remember reading about it online and then talking to a few sources I knew at Sony. And of course, at first, I didn't really understand the magnitude of it and how damaging it would be. That wasn't until the next week, I believe, when they started leaking all these documents and information. And I started to see some of the stuff that was coming out and realized just how serious this was.
For those who don't remember, the hack was quickly connected to North Korea and Kim Jong-un's anger over the film The Interview. It starred Seth Rogen and James Franco as a couple of TV journalists who are going to interview and potentially assassinate the North Korean president. And at the time, we were interviewing the screenwriter Dan Sterling. This is back in 2014.
You know, I was at a party on a Saturday night where the host was introducing me to everybody at the party as, this is the guy that brought down Sony. That's right. It was funny.
Were you flattered by that?
Well, the first 400 or 500 times the joke was made, it was funny. Except actually, it's in a way, it's actually not funny to me.
How was the hack essentially blamed on the movie? And was that theory actually borne out after the fact?
North Korea was, in fact, behind the hacking, and Kim Jong-un was very, very mad that this, you know, American film was mocking him. North Korea is a very poor country, but they do actually have a kind of very good hacking program, and he wanted to stop this film from coming out and or punish Sony for having made it, and he was pretty successful on both fronts. At the time, the leading theory of experts was it was North Korea, but a lot of people around Sony thought it couldn't be. They thought maybe it was angry ex-employees or rivals or something. But the FBI, about a year ago, concluded pretty definitively that it was North Korea. And in fact, they indicted somebody who was part of a North Korean-backed hacking team that was called the Lazarus Project. And it was for numerous cyber crimes, including the intrusion at Sony.
A thing that a lot of people forget is that the movie didn't really get released. I mean, Sony was so worried about it that they pulled the release and then they kind of backtracked on that. And at the time, we were talking with a guy named James Kirst. He's the founder of LA's Downtown Independent Theater. He is in the studio talking about the movie, and this is what happens.
There's been so much buzz. We're getting calls about it. My phone's ringing.
Yep.
Oh, it's the rep from Sony.
Go ahead, take it.
Hi, this is Jim.
So he actually gets a call from Sony in the middle of the interview saying, "Can you play our movie in your theater?" It ends up not getting much of an exhibition schedule at all, does it?
No, it only was released in a few hundred independent theaters briefly. What happened was the hackers threatened that they were gonna bomb or cause violence and attack any theater that played the film. And, you know, understandably, a lot of theaters didn't want to play it as a result. And Sony, you know, incorrectly said they weren't going to force any theater to play it, even though it had contractual obligations to do it. And then it was this crazy thing where a few hundred independent theaters did play it. And it was also released online simultaneously by a few companies that were willing to do that. Not many people ended up seeing the film as a result. So if that was Kim Jong-un's goal, he was very successful at that. Most people didn't see the film, and Sony was severely damaged by the hack. So you've got to give the win to North Korea here, very sadly.
Well, let's talk about how Sony was damaged by the hack. You spent a lot of time looking through documents released in the hack for part of your research into your book, The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. So what did it reveal about Sony, and how did it, more important, reveal how the studio had kind of lost its way?
All right. So the hack just released tons of emails from the, you know, top executives at the time, as well as internal documents, really sensitive financial stuff. And it revealed that when it comes to the interview, that they had had numerous discussions about something like this happening and didn't take it seriously. There was a lot of conflict between the top executives at the studio, and they were just having a lot of trouble coming up with major motion picture franchises that could compete with, you know, the Marvels and the Fast and Furiouses of the world. It was really an amazing insight into a studio that was struggling to adapt to the modern movie business.
Well, I want to ask about Marvel, because one of the most remarkable pieces of information in your book is how and why Sony refused to pay $25 million for almost all of Marvel's superheroes in the late 90s. So what did that episode say about how Hollywood was changing and how Sony really missed the future?
Yeah, Hollywood, you know, in the late 90s was not ruled by franchises the way it is now. It was really ruled by movie stars. And so Sony thought, well, we've got Adam Sandler, we've got Will Smith. That's what really is valuable. You know, we're not going to waste our money on these B-list superheroes. Maybe Spider-Man's valuable, but that's all. That's all they wanted. And of course, Sony horrifically miscalculated. And there's a lot of stuff in the hack about Sony's attempts to fix that mistake, including trying to revive the Spider-Man franchise a few years ago.
I think it's fair to say that in the wake of the Sony hack, a lot of studios and a lot of companies probably tried to improve their firewalls and had better IT security. But do you think there's a bigger lesson about Hollywood that might be remembered from the hack? Do you think it still has an impact on the business, and do people still talk and think about what happened to Sony?
Yeah, people all the time reference Sony when they talk about how much sensitive stuff should we say on an email. There's a sense that there's this knowledge, not just sense, knowledge that email is never truly secure. And if you're not necessarily comfortable with the world knowing about it, then you probably shouldn't put it in an email.
If you don't have something nice to say, don't say it at all, I guess.
Yeah, or at least say it on the phone.
Ben Fritz is an editor at The Wall Street Journal, and he is the author of the book, The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. Ben, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Sure, John. It was my pleasure.
Coming up on The Frame, Lena Waithe wrote the new movie Queen and Slim, in which Melina Matsoukas makes her feature directing debut, and they are thrilled to be working together. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. This week, Queen and Slim opens in theaters. It stars Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out and newcomer Jodie Turner-Smith. They play an African-American couple who are driving home from an awkward first date when a white police officer pulls them over.
You failed to execute a turn signal back there.
Oh, my bad.
Step out of the vehicle.
Can I ask why, officer?
No, you may not.
Put your hands on your head and get on the ground now.
Are you serious?
Get on the ground!
Why is he under arrest?
Get back in the car!
I am an attorney!
Deal,
I'm
just
reaching
deal.
For my cell phone!
Queen and Slim is written by Lena Waithe and directed by Melina Matsoukas, who is making her feature directing debut. She's done TV and lots of music videos, including Beyoncé's Formation. Waithe and Matsoukas collaborated on an Emmy-winning episode of Master of None before making Queen and Slim, and there were a number of reasons why Melina thought the film should be set in Ohio.
Lena had written that into the script because Ohio still has a death penalty.
Correct.
So obviously it was really important to Queen's character because she defends people on death row. But I had traveled to Ohio for a Nike commercial a couple of years before. And I had been to Cleveland. There was an area of Cleveland that's in a really black neighborhood. And I had shot, I still had the location pictures on my phone on this one street called St. Clair. So I was really pushing to start there. I wanted to start in a really cold environment and have them travel south through the story. I always think of it as a reverse slave escape narrative. And Cleveland was also the last stop on the Underground Railroad before slaves would get to Canada. So I thought that was really pertinent, like metaphorically, for our film. And then also it's where Tamir Rice was killed, where I got a chance to visit the playground where he was shot dead. And so I just felt like it was the right place for us. She wrote it in, and then, like, you know, visually I had been there. I had witnessed, like, how pertinent it was to us. And then when, you know, a lot of other people on our crew were really pushing for us to just stay in New Orleans because that's where we were already shooting, and obviously for budget reasons it's easier to just shoot in one place. But I wanted to travel with them, and I wanted them to feel that journey mm-hmm. as actors and let that inform their performance. So we went up to Cleveland, and while we were scouting, we were on that street, St. Clair, and it was my director's scout, so we hadn't decided definitely to go there. But maybe in the half hours, like a Tuesday night, at least 6 Black people were pulled over by cops in a half hour time period. And one of them was in a white Accord. And
that you are watching happen
as
in
we're
real
scouting.
Time.
We're scouting
she,
which
like,
block
me
we wanted to
picture.
Be on.
I'm
yeah.
Like, whoa.
And we had been staying in downtown Cleveland where there was no police presence. So this was like a mm-hmm. trap in a Black neighborhood to just like get people. Mm-hmm. And in a half hour, they were all pulled over. And there was this one car, it was a Accord. And it was the Cleveland police car was mm-hmm. behind him, pulled him over. And my production designer took a shot of it. And I was like, that's Slim. That's Slim. That's his car. That's who he is. Like, he's every man. And we have to be here.
I want to play some audio from a police stop. I think you're going to know what this is. This is Sandra Bland being pulled over in Texas.
Hello, ma'am. With the Texas Highway Patrol, the reason for your stop is you didn't fail. You failed to signal your lane change. You got your driver's license insurance with you? Can you give me a few minutes, all right? You okay?
I'm waiting on you. This is your job. I'm waiting on you. What do you want me to
do? Oh, you seem very irritated.
I am. I really am. I feel like this cap is what I'm getting a ticket for. I was getting out of your way. You were speeding up, tailing me. So I move over, and you stop me. So, yeah, I am a little irritated, but that doesn't stop you from giving me a ticket. So, that's the ticket.
1237. I'm out. Are you done?
You asked me what was wrong, and I told you.
Okay.
So now I'm done, yeah.
Okay. You mind putting out your cigarette, please? If you don't mind.
I'm in my car. Why do I have to put out my cigarette?
Well, you can step on out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car. Step
no,
out of the car.
No, you don't have the right.
Step
not,
out of the car.
You do not have the right to do that.
I do have the right. Now step out or I will remove you.
I refuse to talk to you other than to identify myself.
Step out or I will remove you.
I am getting removed.
What is it like to hear that?
I've watched that video hundreds of times. Every time I hear it, it's debilitating. It's infuriating. It's upsetting, obviously. It's emotional. You know, I saw so much of myself in Sandra Bland, and actually Lena had written it. We worked on an episode of Master of None called Thanksgiving, and mm-hmm. she wrote in those lines that could have been any of us. And I remember watching that video over and over because I wanted Queen's reaction to somewhat, you know, mirror Sandra Bland when they're pulled over, because they're pulled over for no reason, just like she was.
Mm-hmm. And I should add, Sandra Bland died in police custody 3 days later. She was found hanged in her jail cell.
Right. And, you know, she was being picked on and prodded and harassed by a policeman that she pulled over to get out of his way, mm-hmm. you know, and then he pulls her over for not using his signal.
Yeah, to me, it's just traumatizing. And I think people don't realize, for particularly Black people, when these stories come across our news feeds, our televisions, our Instagram feeds, it's not just another story. It's not just a piece of news to us. It's like a piece of us dies every mm-hmm. time we hear about a person being, particularly a Black person, an unarmed Black person being killed by a police officer. It's we are all living in a state of trauma. And I think that's where the movie was absolutely born out of for me. And I think that's why I knew I needed Melina to do it with me, because it was something so personal. It was something so dark. And there's very few people I trust with that level of vulnerability that I was in, that space that I was in. And I'd already trusted Melina once with something very vulnerable. And she handled me and it with care. And we bonded very quickly. And so with this, it was important that we take this journey together.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Lena Waithe, the writer of Queen and Slim, and Melina Matsoukas, who directed the film. Is it fair to say that Queen and Slim, like Tamir Rice, like Sandra Bland, like Eric Gardner, are fighting in a war that they don't even know they're a part of?
Absolutely. I feel like listening to that, we feel like we're hunted. you know, and I think that that's shown in just hearing those words. It's there's this war going on. And, you know, Lena called it the other day a genocide, which is exactly right.
I want to play another clip from the film. And this is, I think, kind of a moment of reckoning between Queen and Slim. I'm going to play it, and then we'll talk about the look on Slim's face in this conversation.
Where are you going?
I'm going to find somebody with a phone so I can call my family.
If you do that, then they'll know where we are.
Great.
What if they kill us?
Don't say that.
There's no guarantee they won't. You're a black man that killed a cop and then took his gun.
I'm not a criminal.
You are now.
I want to ask you, Melina, about the look on Daniel Kaluuya's face in that scene.
The looks in every scene that he gives. He's just a giver with his emotion. You know, he feels the weight. He feels the gravity. He's starting to understand how he will be viewed, that he is now viewed as a monster, you know, when he was in the right, when he was just trying to defend himself and his woman in that moment. But I think, you know, his eyes, I think, in every scene, especially that one, they really transform. And the weight of what just happened is starting to land on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think to me, the look that breaks my heart every time, I've seen the movie a lot, but it's just after that when he says, I just want to go home.
Yeah, he's pleading. He's I just want to go home and I want to see my family.
And I think that it's interesting because I remember writing that and as a person who was not super close to my family, but I was thinking in that moment when you're afraid, all you want to do is get home to your family because that's all you can think about. And it's also, too, I think about Fruitvale Station, you know, and that moment where Michael B. Jordan says, I just want to go home. You know, that's what we all want. Mm-hmm. We all want to go home.
And it weighed on me because I am close to my family. Mm-hmm. So, like, in times of extreme need or terror or fear, that's where I want to go to the nest, right. You know, to my mom and my father,
right.
Who won't ever look at me as a criminal, you know. And right. I think he has that same satisfaction and that love in his home.
Slim has a line in the movie, I ain't gonna bend the world, mm-hmm. which feels to me like a little bit of an echo of what Martin Luther King Jr. said, which is the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Mm-hmm. And I think Slim says, no, it doesn't. I can't change it.
Well, a little bit of it is Slim doesn't feel as if he needs to be some famous person. He doesn't need to leave a mark on the world to know that he existed. And there's something very honorable about that. And I'm speaking to you as a person who, in a way, who is known, like people are aware of who I am, or somebody could say that, you know, I'm leaving a mark on the world. But what I think I wrestle with is that everyone's life is just as valid as mine. Just because of how I make a living or the fact that I've done something that people notice doesn't mean that my life is more valuable than someone else's. And I think that's really what I wanted to do with Slim, is that he represents the majority, that they're working every day trying to be the best person that he can be. And he has a very different experience of that because he's a black man. So his life is political, whether he likes it or not.
Why were they named Queen and Slim?
Slim is sort of born out of like old school black lingo in terms of like if you look at old like black 70s movies, you'll hear a black man refer to each other. It's like, what up, Slim? What's going on, Slim? And then for the Queen thing is almost self-explanatory. And then I think that all black women are queens.
Up next on The Frame, more of my conversation with Lena Waithe and Melina Matsoukas, the writer and director of Queen and Slim. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame. We continue our conversation now with Lena Waithe and Melina Matsoukas, the writer and director of Queen and Slim. The film stars Daniel Kaluuya as Slim. He made a big splash when he starred in Jordan Peele's Get Out, and newcomer Jodie Turner-Smith plays Queen. We pick up the conversation with Melina Matsoukas.
Well, when we started, Lena had already talked to Daniel. And what should have been, you know, a 5-minute conversation turned into what hopefully will be a lifelong collaboration, mm-hmm. because he's an immense talent. And so we had Daniel, and it was important to both Lena and I that we use this opportunity to create a platform for a new black actress, for a new voice. because we don't get many of those opportunities, and we knew we didn't want to waste it. So we wanted to find our queen. We wanted her to be introduce somebody new. And then we needed to have somebody that would stand up against Daniel. And then the other thing that was really important for us is that she was dark-skinned, that we could – I'd love to be a part of redefining what beauty is in the world. And we've never seen a love story between two dark-skinned actors on screen.
That the tendency is to get light-skinned actors so they feel more white.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, in this country, obviously, there's a tendency that the lighter you are, the more Eurocentric looking you are, that's what's considered beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. And so many of our brothers and sisters don't grow up really having pride in themselves as dark-skinned beauties. And so that was really important. And then also to show the love, like, between those two people that could be dark-skinned and have that and represent it to the next generation, because that's not even something I grew up in.
And there's also a way that you light their bodies that's fascinating, and that is also unusual.
Yeah, I'm very protective, I think, of lighting black skin. I'm very selective when it comes to choosing a DP. I also study cinematography in grad school, so I'm very specific in how I want to portray black bodies on screen. And I want it to feel real, at times fantastical. There's certain elements of light that are more beautiful on our skin because it's really reflective than others, so I utilize that. And I like to play with color and tone and shadows and brightness as well in order to translate my visual language.
Lena, I want to ask you about this balance in the film between brutality and beauty, because this is a story about something that is brutal that starts this couple on the road, and yet it's also a love story. And there's a lot of beauty, not only in their relationship, but also in the people they meet along the way and the people who care for them. When you're writing the story and trying to figure out the balance that you want to strike, what were the things that you were focused on?
A big thing was I wanted to focus on a sense of community. And it was a bit of a meditation on Underground Railroad for a modern age, in a way. And the fact that it does feel like we're at war. You know, I think there's this sort of element of people being worried, will this film start a race riot? You know, and will this start a war? Will this make temperatures even hotter? But the thing is, they said the same thing about Do the Right Thing. They said the same thing about Boys in the Hood. They said the same thing about New Jack City. Like, all these.
These are conversations while you're pitching this idea?
This was, I think, once we were done.
Okay.
You know, and
once people started to see the film.
Yes. Okay. And to me, it's like, when writing it, I'm very aware of that war that we're already in.
Because it's truth.
Yeah. And so it was almost about, what side are you on? And they never know, when they go out into the world or who they're encountering, if they're on their side, if they're not, you'd be surprised sometimes about who's on their side and who isn't. And there's so many influences that I have, whether, you know, I think people are quick to say Thelma and Louise and Bonnie and Clyde, which I understand, but also Wizard of Oz is in there. You know, it's also
The Wiz,
you know, it's also Set It Off. There's, you know, elements of Badlands. There's references that I think people don't expect me to have, or don't think that I'm as well versed in cinema as much as I am. Like, I've watched so many different kinds of cinema that in writing it, I really wanted to break rules that had been set up. Like, I don't have a cop that you sympathize with along this journey to cut away to. I'm letting the story unfold slowly and intentionally. But for me, the people they encounter, even though these are somewhat small roles, I wanted every role to feel gigantic.
I want to ask you both about this idea that to be provocative, to make a point, that people are going to feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
That idea of making sure the audience, white or black, is challenged. Was that something you were consciously thinking about as you're making the movie, or as you're seeing it play in front of audiences now?
That's the way I was raised. You know, my parents, they were very political and they were very leftist. And I was brought up to know that I needed to give back to the world and give back the privilege that I had been given, and to have some sort of activism. And what would that be? And so, you know, this is my activism. This is my protest art. This is the way I've chosen to, you know, or to be a part of the change that is necessary in this world. even if it's in a small way. And yes, in order to be part of the revolution, like, you really have to make some people uncomfortable, you know?
Nina Simone said it is an artist's duty to reflect the times. And I think that is something I live by. And I don't like pulling punches. I'm not a Black artist that necessarily believes in writing about a world that I want to live in. For me, it makes more sense to write about the world in which I do live, because I want to hold a mirror up to us and force us to look at the reflection even when we want to turn away.
Lena and Lena, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
That was amazing. Yeah.
Lena Waithe is the writer of Queen and Slim. Melina Matsoukas is the film's director. It's in theaters on November 27th. And that'll do it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you tomorrow.